Remember the good old days before Microsoft Word had autosave? You'd type up some important document and then your computer would freeze and you'd lose hours of work just because you forgot to hit save? Well, that's what it's like going online without ExpressVPN. Every time you're connected to an unencrypted network, whether it's in an airport, a hotel, a cafe, or anywhere, your online data is not secure. Any person on that same network who knows what they're doing can gain access to your personal data. Bank logins, credit card details, passwords, all the stuff you don't want people seeing. Unfortunately, hacking has become much easier than it used to be. People don't even have to be exceptionally skilled to do it, and there's a lot of money to be made by selling your information on the dark web. ExpressVPN stops hackers from stealing your data by creating a secure, encrypted tunnel between your device and the internet. It's incredibly easy to use. Once the app is running, you literally click one button to get protected. And it works on your phone, laptop, tablet, and more, so you can stay protected on the go. I've been using ExpressVPN for a little while now, and I can rest easy knowing my info is safe and secure. I've heard horror stories of people who've been hacked, and it sounds like a massive pain to try to get any resolution in the aftermath, so I am not interested in finding out what that process is like. Secure your online data today by visiting expressvpn.com/film. That's expressvpn.com/film. And you can get an extra 3 months free. expressvpn.com/film.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Tuesday, July 2nd, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the latest film and TV news. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film staff writer and box office analyst, Ryan Scott.
Hey, everyone. How's it going?
All right, Ryan, let's get into it. Tell me about everything I need to know about what happened at the box office this past weekend.
Yeah, so Inside Out 2 is continuing its tear. It topped the charts for the third straight weekend. The actuals came in. Normally when we're talking about this stuff, we're talking about the weekend estimates, which are always very close to the actuals. But so today we're going to be talking about the actual numbers. So Inside Out 2 made $57.5 million in its third weekend, meaning it only dropped 43%. And it is now officially our first billion-dollar grosser since Barbie last year. So, yeah, this is a big deal. It's also the first animated movie to make $1 billion since Mario. So that's a big deal. It is almost certainly going to end up passing the overall total of Mario by the end of this. Yeah, I mean, it's just crazy. I expected, you know, it would hit this mark in early July, but not by July 1st. You know, like, so it's going. Inside Out 2 did it in 19 days, whereas Barbie did it in 17 days. So, you know, Barbie did $1.44 billion. So you can kind of start to see where, you know, this might land. Just for context, Pixar's highest grossing movie ever is The Incredibles 2 with $1.2 billion. So Inside Out 2 is, barring a collapse, assured to pass that at this point. I mean, I don't think any of us expected this movie to be here this quickly. I think we maybe thought this movie was going to do well, but I mean, I think that I would categorize this as a pleasant surprise for all around.
Yeah, definitely. I wonder if there's any other sort of observations that you have about this movie and its success that we haven't talked about already, because we've kind of like diagnosed, you know, what Pixar could do moving forward and sort of the impact that this is having on the box office overall already when the movie sort of came out of the gate really hot. I'm wondering now that it's actually like officially passed this threshold, if you have any, I don't know, different thoughts about it, or if it puts it in a different context for you.
I think the big thing for me is that Inside Out, the original, resonated with me, certainly. Like, and I've talked multiple times on multiple podcasts about how that movie made me cry harder than any other movie has ever made me cry, and I've refused to ever rewatch it since because of that. and it's also why I haven't seen the sequel yet, because I've been going through some stuff, and I haven't, like, been ready for that emotional turmoil, which oddly enough, A Quiet Place Day One ended up giving me, which I wasn't expecting, but we can talk about that. But yeah, so I guess for me, it's realizing the resonance that first movie clearly had with that generation, because I was a full blown adult when Inside Out came out. So like, I was a kid when Incredibles came out, you know, I was a kid when Toy Story came out. I was a kid when, you know, a lot of these other movies came out, and then, you know, you know, like you see the sequels as adults. So I guess for me, I didn't realize that Agree to Which, Inside Out became that movie, that Pixar sequel you see as an adult thing. You know what I'm saying? Like, I think for me, I underestimated the degree to which Inside Out, you know, Inside Out made a lot of money, and I took that for granted at the time. But I guess I also took for granted the way that it resonated in a very meaningful way.
There were conversations around the time that Inside Out, the original, came out, basically saying that, like, or sort of maybe loosely implying that Pixar had gotten like a little too heady for its own good. Like, that maybe this idea is not, you know, the idea of like going into a young girl's mind and like anthropomorphizing emotions and stuff is like maybe Pixar going a little off the creative deep end here. But I think exactly what you're saying, like, that it's proven that the success of the sequel has proven that idea not only resonated with audiences at the time, because that movie made a lot of money when it came out, but has become like a staple film that kids grow up with, and like actually has proven to be like I don't know what you would call it, like a growth movie or something like that. I don't know what kind of terminology you can use to determine
is. And I think that's the thing, and that's why I get like a little uppity about the part that made me so upset in that original movie, is that like a lot of it really is like, oh wow, like even as an adult, you're like, some of this is really profound. And then they kill Bing Bong and you're like, why would you do that to me? You know, it's had no purpose. You just wanted to make me upset. I think that, and when I talk about, because I've given several impassioned speeches about Pixar's place in cinema, and I think Inside Out is a perfect example of like why Pixar is important. And I think that this movie's success to me further cements that. Mm-hmm. I think that I'm just glad that Pixar is finding success, even if it is with a sequel. And I just hope this continues to bear out, as whatever the next Pixar projects come, you know, are. For now, I'm just hopeful and happy, I guess, is really what I'm left with.
Yeah. Okay. So actually, run through the top 10 at the box office for me.
Oh, that's right. We were going to start doing that. I apologize, dear listeners. So let's go through the top 10 here real quick. So Inside Out 2, as mentioned, topped the charts again with $57.5 million. A Quiet Place Day 1 in its first weekend opened at $52.2 million. Coming in at number 3 was also a new one with Horizon and American Saga Chapter 1 with an $11 million opening. Coming in at number 4, holding strong in its fourth week, and is Bad Boys Ride or Die with $10.3 million. Number 5, I'm going to butcher the pronunciation on this, but an Indian import called Kalki 2898 AD, surprising, entering the top 5 with $5.2 million. Number 6 was The Bike Riders, dropping hard like a rock in its second weekend with $3.3 million, dropping 66%. Number 7 was The Garfield Movie, taking $2 million. Number 8 was Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, still hanging around with $1.7 million. Number 9 was Kinds of Kindness, which expanded into 490 theaters and made $1.5 million. And number 10 was something called Jat and Juliet 3 with $1.5 million. I literally do not know what that is.
Wow, never heard of that.
But yeah, so that's where we're at. There's certainly some stuff to discuss there outside of what Inside Out 2 did for the industry as a whole.
Yeah, so let's move to A Quiet Place Day 1. We talked about that movie on Friday's episode of the show. You can go back and listen to that if you are just joining us for the first time. But what did you think about that movie, Ryan? Because I haven't had a chance to talk about the film itself with you yet.
I'm so sorry. I just took a drink of something and it went down the wrong pipe. I've said this before, but the original A Quiet Place was my favorite movie of 2018. I was at the South by Southwest world premiere. It blew me away. And then I thought A Quiet Place Part 2 was a fantastic follow-up. And I was always resident about this movie because I was like, okay, the prequel, do we really need to know? Are they going to answer questions we don't have? And as many others have pointed out, this movie went above and beyond the Call of Duty in my eyes. It is a real genuine movie unto itself that just so happens to be a prequel in a pre-existing franchise. It wrecked me emotionally. I cried way more than I would have anticipated crying in a Quiet Place prequel. And I loved it. It's right up near the top of my favorite movies of the year so far, actually. So
that's awesome. Yeah. So yeah. The good news is that this movie performed pretty well in its opening weekend. So tell me about that.
It did. So as I mentioned, 52.2 million domestic, which is a new record for the series, for an opening weekend domestically, but it also did 45.5 million overseas. So it is, just about $98 million worldwide, which means it has now in a single weekend become the highest grossing horror movie of the year worldwide. Previously that honor had belonged to a South Korean import, called, Exuma, which I've talked about a couple of times on the show, I believe.
I've heard good things about that one.
Yeah. I have too. It's streaming on Shudder currently, so you don't have to go out of your way to look for it. It's readily available, but, that movie had made 97.6 million worldwide. So, A Quiet Place, barely notching past that, but again, in a single weekend. Now, as far as American horror movies go, we have not had, you know, in 2022 and 2023, we've talked a lot about how horror was kind of the genre that you could rely on. But the highest grossing horror movie from Hollywood this year had been Night Swim, with $54.6 million. And that came out in January, you know, and then you had The First Omen with 53.8 and Tarot, another movie we've talked about quite a bit, with 48.1. But, you know, and those were fine relative to their budgets, you know, save for The First Omen. But we have not had, you know, a Smile, a Megan, a Black Phone, an Evil Dead Rise. We've had none of that. So this is the first time we've had that actual, like, straight up hit horror movie in theaters, which is very nice to see.
Do you know, like, off the top of your head, what horror movies have yet to come out this year that could potentially keep this train rolling a little bit? Like, we've got Maxine this week, which is A24's sequel to X and Pearl, which I'm excited about, but I'm pretty sure, isn't that right?
Yeah, that's the fifth, I believe. I'm actually not certain of the rollout strategy. Like, I don't know if it's nationwide at once or if it's sort of limited. And then, but yeah, Maxine, and then you got Long Legs coming up, which I actually think is going to do better than people think it's going to do. But again, that's not like going to challenge for the crown, right? Like, that's not going to challenge for 100 worldwide or anything. But yeah, I think the one that could is, we have M. Night Shyamalan's Trap coming out. And I think those trailers are like vintage Shyamalan. And I think if like the reviews come out, and they don't necessarily have to be as effusive as Split, but if the reviews are good, I think Trap stands to make a lot of money. And then I also think you've got Alien Romulus, which I think is going to do very well. I think that looks like an absolute, you know, like straight up crowd pleaser. So yeah, I think Speak No Evil, I'm a little curious about the remake of that in September. I think that'll do fine.
Terrifier 3 comes out this year too.
And Terrifier 3, I think relatively could be like a breakout sequel, in that Terrifier 2 was made for like $250,000 and it made like 11 million worldwide. Terrifier 3, because it's like a Christmas horror movie, which is like a weird hook too. I think that, you know, if it makes 25 worldwide, would be shocking to me. But yeah, then I think the big one, which shouldn't be of a surprise to anybody, is Smile 2. I think Smile 2 looks, it was one of the things that surprised me the most at CinemaCon, the footage that I saw. I think that trailer's out in the world now. I think people are ready for that. And then my hope is that Nosferatu closes the year out really well with Robert Eggers. But I think that the horror we have coming down the pipeline for the rest of the year, it's easy to see where like almost all of those have a lot of upside. So I'm hopeful that maybe just that the back half was a little, you know, light, and then that the front half was a little light, and the back half is loaded down, is kind of what I'm looking at.
Yeah. So, what other takeaways do you have from A Quiet Place's success? Anything, or do you want to move on to something else?
Well, I guess my concern is that, you know, I mean, also I should mention, it was a $67 million budget. So that's pretty expensive for horror, but this has always been sort of on the blockbuster end of horror, right? Like, it's not just straight horror, it's more sci-fi alien invasion horror, so I think that budget's a little warranted. But I think there's no question that Paramount's gonna do more. Like, they have the video game coming out, which actually looks pretty good.
I didn't even know about that.
A new trailer just dropped today, like a story trailer. It's called a Quiet Place: The Road Ahead. I'm not a big stealth mission guy, so it doesn't look like it's going to be for me to play. Because, you know, obviously the premise is be quiet or whatever. But yeah, so but I, as far as the next movie goes, I think obviously they would probably make A Quiet Place 3 if they can afford to do so, you know, and round out that trilogy. But then I think if they're going to keep trying to do more, I just worry about not bleeding the whole thing dry, because this feels like a minor miracle that that day one exists as it does. So I don't know if you have the same concern, but I feel like it's going to be tough to keep this moving at this quality level. But I'd love to be proven wrong.
Well, I thought BJ had a really good suggestion on Friday's episode where she said that she wanted to see this franchise go international in the next entry, like, you know, show us a different corner of the world or something like that. And I feel like, especially maybe with, I don't know, the way that studios make money and spend money and sort of different kickbacks and financial incentives and all of that kind of stuff, like maybe you could make a cheaper version of a movie in a different country that also has, you know, the effects and quality that people have come to expect from this movie. So and that would be like creatively a different I don't know, a different prospect for audiences, right? Like showing us a different kind of things that doesn't just feel like, all right, now we're back on this treadmill one more time.
Yeah, I didn't want to take BJ's idea, but I do believe, because I did listen to the episode, I do believe that is optimistically the way to go. You know, you could do like a Korean influenced horror, you know, like in, you know, the Quiet Place universe, and some of that would be super cool. So I hope BJ's right. I hope that's what they do. We'll see. But that's my only real thing. So I think, but you know, mostly A Quiet Place day one and is great news. And it's also a great example of like, it didn't top the box office, but it didn't have to. It worked as fantastic counter programming against Inside Out 2. This is how this stuff's supposed to work.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about Horizon, because that's the big one. I haven't actually had a chance to see the movie yet. I'm hoping to see it maybe like next week or something. It's 3 hours long, which I don't know if I knew that and forgot, but I was scrolling through my AMC app and trying to figure out a time to see it. And I was like, oh, well, that changes things, because that becomes like a whole thing instead.
The same thing, because I wanted to go see it maybe last night. And I'm like, oh, that's 3 hours. Like, I don't have time.
But like, I am interested in it, even though I've heard like the reviews are not great. And it our own review from Jeremy Mathai on Slash Film basically says it's like the longest trailer, the most expensive trailer for a movie ever. Like, it seems to be teeing up a lot of what's going to happen in future Horizon and American Saga movies. But
which sort of makes sense. For those that don't know, this is Kevin Costner's new Western. And as we'll get into, a lot of you might not know or care. And I'm not trying to be negative, but there's not really a positive way to spin this. So like, just know that my tone is going to be what I think is appropriate in talking about this movie. But so Kevin Costner has had this as a passion project in his head for a long time. His idea is to make not one, but four of these movies. What's crazy is that Horizon Chapter 2 is not only already filmed, it's coming out in 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
It's already on the books. So they're already selling tickets for it. Now, originally I had heard that the budget for the first two was $100 million. Like, as in it cost $100 million to, you know, like, so as in 50 a piece. Mm-hmm. Now, you had sent me a piece from Variety last week at the end of the week that sort of broke down Costner's big gambit here. And it is actually $100 million for the first one alone. And you have to assume that the other ones are similarly priced. So an $11 million opening for a Western, a genre that does not play well overseas. And by my estimation, there have only ever been two Westerns ever made that could justify a $100 million budget. Being Django Unchained being one of them, and Dances with Wolves being the other.
Because of how much money they ended up making?
Ones. Those are the only ones that have made enough to say, because the any other ones that, you know, there are ones that have made fair amounts of money, but like, they also cost too much, like the Lone Ranger being an example, Wild Wild West being another one. Like, it Westerns don't play well overseas. So when you talk about a $100 million movie, you really are reliant on that. It can't just be, you know, domestic. So, but that being said, so let's say Horizon had the best legs of any movie we've seen in years. Let's say it had like elemental legs where, you know, it goes, even if it made five times its opening weekend, it makes $55 million domestically. That's not enough. You know, for, and now Costner put supposedly $38 million of his own money into this. He has some unnamed angel investors who he won't disclose, who put, I think, about $50 million into it. Warner Brothers is on the hook for a little bit because they had developed it at New Line before things changed. So I guess they have a small stake in the movie, but even Costner has to pay for the advertising. Like, Warner Brothers is just distributing. So
yeah, I saw that. That's very unusual, I think. I was trying to rack my brain of
it's times highly when, unusual.
But yeah, that, when but that filmmakers was, have to foot the bill for their own advertising for the movie.
But that's the agreement. That this is an independent film, essentially. It's one of the more expensive. It's much like what Francis Ford Coppola is doing with Megalopolis. Now, originally, I was all for when I heard Costner kind of finance this himself. I'm like, hey, go off, man. Do your thing. But I mean, this is crazy, you know, like because he's already about to start filming 3. And my thing is like, okay, fine. If it's just your money, whatever. It's at some point you got to think that whoever this other investor is or whoever these other investors are, like someone's going to want their money. You know, like,
well, don't you think they're going to get it in home video? Because that was the big thing Costner was talking about. And you and I talked about this, whatever it was, a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago now, yeah. Where he did that big interview where he was basically saying like, hey, my money comes from DVDs sold at Walmart for all intents and purposes. Like, so he must be banking on that type of response for Horizon. But like, and I know he was like really trying to make the case that like, the DVD market is not as dead as you think. This is still a viable way to right. make money or whatever. But like, I just don't see how that's true. Really? Well, I don't know. Like,
yeah. So let's get into that. Cause I agree. I actually agree with Costner that the DVD market and the Blu-ray market, it's not as dead as Hollywood wants you to think. Cause like, to his point, he's like, you go ask them for those rights and they're going to be like, hell no. You know? Cause like, that's still money. So here's the point though. Movies. So here's why box office is important, even if it is not the be-all, end-all. Because most movies do not profit purely in theaters. But what happens is the more box office you have, the more money you make in every other downstream revenue. Meaning that, like, that's more money on VOD, for sure. That's more money you get for a cable deal. That's more money you get for streaming deals. And yes, that is more DVDs and Blu-rays you will sell at Walmart. Movies that do better in theaters sell better in every window, licensing internationally, all of it, it all depends on how well you do at the box office. Mm-hmm. So it's not to say that Costner's not going to sell some DVDs. That's not to say it's not going to do. I think this is going to do very well on VOD, but is it enough to justify $100 million for this movie and the sequels that are coming? Like, is it, I mean, this has a B- cinema score. This isn't a situation where you have, like, you know, Sound of Freedom last year where it's got like an A cinema score. People love it. Word of mouth. It's going to go crazy. It doesn't seem to be that. So yeah. What's going to happen when Chapter 2 comes out? Is it going to make $6 million opening weekend? And then you have another $100 million movie that made half as much as this one? That's where I'm wondering. And then what happens with, does he have a contingency plan where he can wrap this up in 3 movies? Because I think he's already too deep to pull the plug. But, you know, so I don't know. I don't know what this means. Look, I'm all for the passion project, but it does feel like there's other people's money tied up here.
And yeah, I think that's the good news, actually, is that we can kind of sit back and say, like, all right, well, I mean, this is your money and like your investors have agreed to this, but this is not like going to be the downfall of a studio in the same way that like Cleopatra was in the 1960s or something, where like, you know, all of this money got funneled into it and it was a disaster or whatever. So at least, like, I mean, you know, again, like, cry tears for Warner Brothers, this mega conglomerate that makes billions of dollars a year or whatever, you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm trying not to cape up for the studios or whatever, but like, at least this is one of those scenarios that's not going to have negative ripple effects that mean that like other movies can't be greenlit because this film was such a financial disappointment or whatever, like other movies might be.
Yeah, because I think that's why Warner Brothers ultimately was like, when they saw how expensive it was going to be, they were like, eh. You know, I think they were like, I don't think we can do this. And rightfully so. But then Warner Brothers sort of wisely still gets to attach themselves as the distributor and be like, hey, look, we're supporting, you know, auteur cinema. Like, so they kind of come out looking good in the wash, right? Like, yeah. You know, I don't know. But I mean, yeah, you got to imagine at some point whoever these mysterious investors are that, you know, because like, what's interesting is Coppola said who paid for his movie. You know, like, he's explained how, where all that money come from. Like, Costner's being like, eh, I got money from somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, so like, I don't know. This will be maybe one of the more interesting, like the story behind the movie is more interesting than the movie itself. But look,
yeah, I saw that he's filming like a 6-hour documentary about the making of Horizon. So like maybe that actually will be more interesting.
Maybe. But I guess my thing is this, like, look, I like Costner a lot. Like I'm excited for this movie, but like maybe it would have worked better as a TV show, but it was too expensive as a TV show. Maybe he thought the Yellowstone audience would turn up. Maybe the Yellowstone audience was like, we have Kevin Costner at home. You know, like, I don't know what happened here, but it no matter how you slice it, no matter where the money comes from, I'll just leave you with, under any circumstance, because there's going to be a lot of conversation about this in the coming weeks. There's going to be people trying to spin how this is actually going to be fine. Costner's going to say a lot of rosy things. Under no circumstances in the history of cinema has an $11 million opening been okay for a movie that cost $100 million to make before marketing. Period. End of discussion. That's never been fine. So, like, I don't know how that's fine now, and it's not. So I'll leave it at that.
Okay, let's take a break, and then we'll be right back. So there are a bunch of trailers that came out that I'm going to link to in the show notes. We don't have to really get into them right now, but Batman Caped Crusader, this new animated series, there's a new A24 horror movie called Heretic starring Hugh Grant that looks pretty good. There's a movie called Red One starring Dwayne Johnson and Chris Evans where Dwayne Johnson slaps a Krampus in the face and it looks like one of the worst things I've ever seen.
Yeah, Ben, are you sure you don't want to talk about Red One an awful lot? Because I feel like we should spend the rest of the episode talking only about that.
No, I really wish that I could be like Men in Black neuralized and never have that imagery in my mind again. I will not be seeing Red One. I don't care about this. Everyone involved should be ashamed of themselves. Okay, so I did want to mention real quick, Martin Mull died, unfortunately, at the age of 80. He played Colonel Mustard in the 1985 movie Clue and popped up in a ton of great shows and movies over the years. Mrs. Doubtfire, Jingle All the Way, Robert Altman's The Player, Community, like the list goes on. We were talking about him a little bit before we started recording, Ryan, and you mentioned his appearance on Arrested Development as Gene Parmesan, the private detective character that he played on that show, which is just like one of the all-time great little supporting, almost like a cameo role type of thing.
That first Gene Parmesan episode is one of the funniest goddamn things, like Lucille freaking out every time he reveals himself and it's so obviously him. It's the funniest thing.
So good. I grew up seeing Martin Mull on Sabrina the Teenage Witch. I don't know if that was like too much before your time.
Oh, no, I remember very well that was on syndicated TV all the time. I remember that. Yeah. And I think didn't every guy about our age have a crush on Melissa Joan Hart at some point? Like, didn't
I'm sure. Yes.
Yeah. That was just like absolutely like a rite of passage for, I think, people our age. So, yeah, I think.
Yes. So rest in peace to Martin Mull. I just wanted to mention that. We have BJ wrote a great obituary for him on the site, so I'll link to that in the show notes too. All right, a couple more news items that I wanted to get into here. Channing Tatum is talking a little bit more about a potential 23 Jump Street. This is something that we've talked about on the show. I think we probably tracked this as sort of as it was happening in real time, but at one time there was a plan in place at Sony to do a crossover between the Jump Street movies and the Men in Black franchise. And 23 Jump Street, I believe, was going to be written and directed by Rodney Rothman, who was one of the creative voices behind the 22 Jump Street movies. He was one of the co-directors of Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, or I'm sorry, Into the Spider-Verse. Now Channing Tatum is basically back on the publicity rounds. He's got that new movie Fly Me to the Moon with Scarlett Johansson coming up. And the topic, that Men in Black 23, sort of 23 Jump Street, whatever you want to call that project, came up. And he said, there's a project that was written and it's still the best script that I've ever read for a third movie. And he said, it's just got a lot of bureaucracy, kind of above the line stuff. It's really hard to get it made and we've been trying to get it done. So it sounds like there's still interest in getting this done. And then Ryan, you mentioned that Rothman had shared something on his social media trying to like maybe gin up some support for it too.
Yeah. So this is like sort of a legendary would-be movie. Like this came out around the time, you got to remember, like this information came out around the time that like the Sony leaks and Amazing Spider-Man 2 was coming out and just some of this stuff that just really was like, it wasn't a great time for like Sony PR. So Rodney Rothman took to Twitter and he's like, still a long shot, but nothing is impossible. Want to see the rest? And he shared the script page and just says 23 Jump Street : Men in Black 4. So I think the idea, I don't know, but if you're saying it's Men in Black 4, not like, you know, Men in Black International, whatever tried to do, were they going to try to get Will Smith? Like, were they going to try? Were they going to really try to do this? Now, if that's the case, I understand why you don't do it, because then it becomes the most expensive movie ever made. But like, God, did I want to see this movie? Like, I know some people were like, this sounds so stupid. I wanted to see this so bad. My belief, if you could fold, like, that original Men in Black is so good. And I actually think Men in Black 3 is pretty good. But if you could somehow fold the tones of that original Men in Black and those Jump Street movies together, which I actually think there's a way to do that, this could have been so good. And probably too expensive to ever make sense, but really good. And I think the time is probably passed for it, but I who knows? I don't know. I it almost maybe be funnier now, like, because they're so old. Like, yeah. I don't know, like relative to, I don't know. I don't know what your feelings are on this, but I something about this always seemed to me like just such a weird idea that I was like, hell yeah, let's get weird.
That was exactly my feeling on it, was like, take the shot, go for it, like, do something interesting. And that seemed like a really unusual combination of franchises. And Sony was kind of like floundering in that period a little bit. So I was always of the opinion that they should just like give it a go and see what happens. But obviously that ended up not happening. But especially if like Lord and Miller were still involved, even in just the writing phase, I feel like they could be the people that you're saying to sort of be able to fold those tones together. And like the Jump Street movies specifically have had that meta aspect of being very aware of what kinds of movies they are, what kinds of tropes that they're poking fun at and things like that. Yeah. So I think it was uniquely positioned to be able to cross over with another franchise in that way, because you'd have these characters commenting on that the nature of that crossover in real time, basically.
And like
that would be funny instead of stupid. So
yeah, and especially because the first two movies, like 22 Jump Street, is so brilliant because it really is just them going, no, we're doing the same thing. Like, yeah. and they really exhaust that in like a really funny way, but you can't do that again. So I think the idea of just blowing the whole thing up and going like, no, it's aliens now, like, would be so funny. Like, and just like, and because like, then it's just, I don't know. Like, I just love, and I picture like Nick Offerman, like, maybe he was like a secret, I don't know. I have all these ideas that I could just see it, like, with all the players they had on the table, like, just how good it could have been. So yeah. I don't know. Imagine like Ice Cube in a Men in Black movie. Just picture that for just a second. Like,
yeah,
come on. So good.
Yeah. And like, obviously the first Deadpool movie got made when that sort of test footage or whatever was leaked on the internet. So like, maybe the attention that we're giving it now, and that we've given it on Slash Film, and that, like, you know, if there's enough people out there that make noise, that they want to see this thing, maybe that'll be enough to get Sony to actually try to invest in making it happen for real. So we'll see how that goes. Last thing I wanted to talk about is you wrote a story called Why a Grand Theft Auto Movie Never Happened. And I have not had time to read this yet. I was hoping you could just run through that article with me real quick, because Grand Theft Auto has been a gigantic video game hit for, I mean, well over a decade at this point.
It's been over a decade since Grand Theft Auto 5 came out. You know,
yeah, so that's like, true. So yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. 2013 was when that came out. Yep. I remember that. Well, Jesus. Wow. Time.
Yeah.
It's flying. But yeah. So tell me why a movie has never happened, especially in this like video game era where Hollywood seems to be mining all these video game IPs and trying to bring things to the screen. Why has that never happened?
Yeah. So let's go over to your point of how big of a hit Grand Theft Auto is. Just, I'll give you some numbers real quick before we get going. Grand Theft Auto 5 alone has sold more than 200 million copies and has generated, get this number, more than $8.5 billion in revenue since its release.
Holy cow.
Yeah, and a lot of that has to do with they were able to extend it with Grand Theft Auto Online and stuff, but $8.5 billion. So the series overall has sold 425 million units, which, I mean, do the math alone on what a video game costs, and, you know, and Grand Theft Auto 6 is on the way next year. So this is a behemoth. So we talk about, in 2013, the entire domestic box office was $9 billion, and Grand Theft Auto 5 alone has generated, you know what I mean? Like, these are the numbers we're talking about. Wow. So what happened is a former head writer and VP of creativity at Rockstar Games, a guy named Dan Houser, recently spoke with The Ankler, and he was talking about, you know, that studio was also behind Red Dead Redemption. So naturally, at some point Hollywood comes knocking. And he sort of talked about how this all went. He goes, after a few awkward dates, we'd ask the executives, why would we do this? And the answer to that question was, because you get to make a movie. And then Houser was like, we'd be like, no, what you've described is you making a movie and us having no control and taking a huge risk that we're going to end up paying for with something that belongs to us. And what he's getting at there is that, like, they're surrendering the IP. Hollywood goes and makes their movie. And at that time, keep in mind, you're talking about Resident Evil and these types of movies that are not well received. Mm-hmm. And then they, all of a sudden, their brand is damaged once they're done. So then he went further on to say that they thought we'd be blinded by the lights, and that just wasn't the case. We had what we consider to be a multi-billion dollar IP, and the economics never made sense. The risks never made sense. In those days, the perception was that games made poor quality movies. And then he goes on to say, it's a different time now. And that last bit is important. It is a different time now, but you have to understand that even 5-6 years ago, there was very little evidence that a studio would do well by them. So, you know, that's pretty much what it was. They had the foresight to be like, why would we damage our brand with, you know, a movie that sure could make money, but it's a drop in the bucket for what they ultimately are already making.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's what's important to understand. The video game industry dwarfs Hollywood. Like, it is crazy how much money is generated by the gaming industry. So, yeah, that's really ultimately what it was. They decided not to risk damaging their brand.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of conversation about this probably 10 years ago or so when I think it was called PlayStation Productions formed, which was basically like PlayStation wanted to make movie versions of their games. And the creators were basically saying, like, look, you're going to Hollywood this up, for lack of a better term. You're just going to screw this up. We want some creative control over what's going on here. And I think the idea was that it was supposed to be a production company that allowed the creators of the games to have some of that control. I'm not sure how that's actually played out in practice. I'm thinking of like the Assassin's Creed movie that came out in 2016 and stuff like that.
Well, but I think PlayStation Productions formed after that. And I think like The Last of Us is one of the things that kind of came out of PlayStation Productions, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay. And yeah, so, maybe I'm getting the name wrong. But there were a lot of like swirling talks of companies and production companies like that forming to try to tackle that very thing that this Grand Theft Auto creator is talking about. But it just seems like that never really happened until very recently. So in terms of like the creative control staying with the people who originated the projects, and like, you know, they're very different mediums. So like, it's not always an easy fit. It's not always it's very simple to just port this over. Like there's a lot of complexity that goes into making a very good video game adaptation, which is why it's been so hard for them to actually get 100%.
But again, recently, you know, TV, particularly at, you know, Castlevania, which people gets lost in the conversation a bit, but then you have, you know, The Last of Us, and you've had, you know, Fallout more recently. But then even on the movie side, look, say what you will, but the Sonic the Hedgehog movies have been incredibly successful. I would argue Rampage was a lot of fun. But you're starting to get to this point where, you know, in the Super Mario Brothers movie was a runaway hit. And so you're getting to this point where the stigma against these video game movies is not what it once was. And yep. So, and these adaptations. So it's possible to me that this could circle back around, but what he said made a lot of sense. And I actually respect the restraint on Rockstar's part to be like, nah, let's go ahead and preserve what we got. And I think that's, you know, kind of rare in this business.
Yeah, man, I'm thinking ahead to next year when Grand Theft Auto 6 comes out, and like Hollywood is going to have to clear out on whatever the official release weekend of that game is.
They're
going
to have to clear out that for 2 weeks. They're going to have to, like, it's going to be, one of the comedians, a guy named Che Dureno, was on a podcast. He was talking about, it's going to be like bigger than Avengers Endgame. Like, and I don't know if I agree with that, but like the cultural, it really is going to be just a seismic moment. Like,
yeah,
like
people are going to be in their homes, not doing anything, not going to any, you know, establishments or whatever. Like, it's going to feel like the end of the world or whatever. Like, you can
are you kidding me? I'm calling out of work. Like, I'm not going to be here. I'm sorry, guys. I hope it's not a box office day because I will be playing Grand Theft Auto 6. Like, I'm not.
Yeah, well, I don't think there will be, because I think Hollywood's going to be like, we see this coming, so we're just not going to release anything for a couple weeks. So if that happens, that honestly should happen, because I don't know what kind of counter programming you could possibly do that could withhold, you know,
some kind
like
of rom-com or something that's aimed, like, not to generalize, but the sort of thing, you know, like what's the opposite of the Grand Theft Auto crowd? You
know, yeah, maybe.
It's so fascinating, but we'll see what happens in the coming years.
All right, well, I think that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find more about all the stories that we mentioned on today's show at slashfilm.com and linked in the show notes for this episode. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really does help us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you all tomorrow.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.